Please join me in 1 Samuel chapter 23, verse 29, the final verse of the chapter, where David has just escaped from King Saul at the Rock of Escape because Saul got word that the Philistines were invading somewhere over on the west side of Judea, and he had to go and take care of that. So I told you, in my estimation, the place where the Rock of Escape is located is probably just a few miles northwest of Masada, which is down near the coastline of the Dead Sea. David was probably fleeing eastward through the wilderness of Maon and came to this wadi system that winds its way down into the flatland on the west side of the Dead Sea. And once Saul gave up the chase, David would have found himself down here on the edge of the sea. So we are told that what happens next is verse 29. David went up from there. Notice the mention of going up, and lived in the strongholds of En-Gedi. So he's at the lowest place in the world, the level of the Dead Sea, 1,400 feet, I think, something like that, below sea level. And about 10 miles north of Masada, so probably 6 or 7 miles from where David came down to the coast of the Dead Sea, there's a little community called En-Gedi. It's been there for a very long time. And it's built up around a stream that is fed by a spring. And it's called the Spring of the Wild Goats. That's what the name En-Gedi means. It's a nice little green valley. And even to this day, there are people that are living near the edge of that stream. So David goes up into the wadi system to the west of the En-Gedi community and starts living there in this wilderness region, but a wilderness that has access to fresh water. And so he's hiding, and that's when Saul finds out where he's at. Chapter 24, verse number 1. When Saul returned from following the Philistines, so he chases the Philistines off, he was told, "Behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." So Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the wild goats' rocks. So Saul whittles down his force, his pursuit force, to about 3,000 of his best guys. And he figures that should be sufficient to track down and annihilate David's ragtag force of 600. Especially since they're running low on supplies and Saul is very well supplied. So somewhere west of En-Gedi, up in this wilderness that I was talking about, Saul begins his search. Now, verse 3. He came to the sheepfolds by the way, where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. So the community of En-Gedi probably has shepherds that take care of sheep out here along this water system that's coming in from the west. And one of the places where they took care of those sheep has a cave. And Saul and his guys have stopped here in their search. And it must be the middle of the day. Saul goes into the cave to basically rest during the heat of the day. Now, some people, some commentators have suggested that the relieving himself here means that he was going to go in and have a bowel movement, that he was going to go in and go to the bathroom. I have my doubts about that. It is much more likely that military guys on maneuvers are going to just use some out-of-the-way place near their camp, just dig a hole, go, and cover it back up again. In fact, that's kind of what the Jewish instructions were in the law. You go outside the camp, dig a hole, go, cover the hole back up, and come back to camp and clean up. So it's much more likely that what we have here is Saul coming in to take a nap during the heat of the day, because it's going to be nice and cool inside this cave. Then we get to the really wild part of the story. Second half of verse number 3. Now David and his men were sitting in the innermost parts of the cave. Evidently, David and at least some of his guys had the same idea. It's hot. Let's go into this cave and rest during the hot part of the day. And wouldn't you know it, suddenly they find themselves trapped inside the cave by the arrival of Saul's force. So they have no choice but to hide in the back of the cave and wait for Saul and his men to leave. But they don't leave. Saul himself comes into the cave and lays down and apparently goes to sleep. Verse number 4. The men of David said to him, and you have to picture this all happening in very quiet whispers after Saul is asleep. Okay? Here is the day of which he who has said to you. Okay, so you can picture that in your head. So I can't whisper the whole time because we won't be able to get the words out properly here. So picture this whispering that's going on between David and his guys. Here's the day of which he who has said to you, behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it will seem good to you. Now, what is this a reference to? It seems as if David's either had a dream or a vision, or the prophet Gad or the high priest Ahimelech has told him that at some future date, Saul is going to be put into David's path and he can do whatever he wishes with him. So David's men say, this is your chance, David. Just cut his throat and be done with him. But David arose and stealthily cut off a corner of Saul's robe. So David, instead of cutting his throat, goes up close enough and cuts off some of that purple fringe that is on every Israeli's outer garment. Remember, this is the purple fringe, the purple prominence that, according to the law, they're supposed to wear as a reminder that they are a child of the covenant. As they go through their day, this thing will come into their peripheral vision through movement. And that's supposed to remind them, I'm a person who keeps God's covenant. So David goes up and slices that particular part of Saul's robe off. And immediately he regrets doing that. Verse number 5. Afterward, David's heart struck him because he'd cut off a corner of Saul's robe. It just seemed to him to be sacrilegious to have cut off this piece of religious wear. It would be like cutting off someone's cross necklace if they were a very serious believer. Now, Saul is not a very serious believer, but David is. And so he sees this as, man, I shouldn't have done that. Now, he said to his men, "He who is forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, he who is anointed." Now, you see there are a couple of different words for Lord in the Hebrew. The first Lord is the word for my master. So Saul is David's master because he's the king and he's his father-in-law. So that's Adonai. And then the second Lord, the one that's got the special formatting to the lettering that you should see in your Bible, that's the divine name, he who is. So Saul is David's king, father-in-law, and master, but he is also God's anointed one. So he who is forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, he who is anointed, to put out my hand against him, seeing he who is anointed. So David feels I shouldn't have even mutilated his religious clothing, let alone cut his throat, because God should deal with that. God's the one that put him into this position. God's the one that should take him out. That's David's attitude. Verse 7, so David persuaded his men with these words and did not permit them to attack Saul. Evidently, several of them didn't have the same problem David did on this issue. They're like, I don't care. I'll slit his throat. You don't have to raise a finger. I'll take him out. But David says, no, no one's touching the Lord's anointed. God will deal with that. And so Saul rose up and left the cave and went on his way. And so he wakes up from his siesta and goes back out with his men, and he's not even aware how close he just came to death, how he could have had his throat slit so very easily by the guy that he's been chasing. Verse number 8. Afterward, David also arose and went out of the cave. So they wait for Saul and his men to move away from the cave entrance, away from the sheepfolds that they've been kind of resting at during the heat of the day. And then David and his guys, they slip out of the cave, and then they probably go up to a higher point on the side of the hill, because this is all happening in the Wadi system that feeds down into En-Gedi. Very rugged. Last trip that we made to Israel, we actually got up and got a nice good view of this area. And it is tough going. If somebody got up on a ridgeline above you, even a matter of, 100 feet, you'd never be able to get up to them. They'd get away long before you could get to them. So David and his guys get into a position above Saul and his men, and David then calls out after Saul, "My Lord the King!" And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the earth and paid homage. So David shows him respect, even at this distance, bows down in front of him. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, 'Behold, David seeks your harm?'" Now take note of that. That is very, very important to where we're going to go next in the book of the Psalms. Saul has convinced himself that David is his enemy, but Saul is also being told by a whole bunch of people around him that David is his enemy. And so David asks him, "Why are you listening to those lies? Behold, this day your eyes have seen how he who is gave you today into my hand in the cave. Some told me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not put out my hand against my Lord, for he who is his anointed," the Mashiach, the Messiah. Remember, this is the Hebrew word for the king. See, my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand. For by the fact that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, you may know and see that there is no wrong or treason in my hands. I've not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it. So you can picture this in your mind, can't you? David kind of holding up that little piece of the purple fringe, waving it around so that Saul can kind of see it at a distance. And Saul would have immediately, you know, checked his garments and seen that he's got a piece of his purple fringe missing. And by that, he knows that David is speaking the truth. That David had a knife or a dagger within inches of his throat and could have killed him, but didn't. Verse 12. May he who is judge between me and you. May he who is avenge me against you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancient says, out of the wicked comes wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you. So David is offering to Saul evidence that I will not end your life. I had the chance, but I didn't do it. I had other guys that wanted to do it. I would not let them do it. God's going to have to deal with you on that. I'm putting you in the Lord's hands. And as the proverb says, wicked comes from wicked people. And I didn't count against you any wicked activities. So I must not be wicked. Verse number 14. After whom has the king of Israel come out? After whom do you pursue? A dead dog? A flea? So he's like, why are you out here chasing me? I am a nobody. I am less than a dead dog. I am less than a flea on a dead dog. I'm just one guy with a few hundred guys just trying to stay out of your way. So this is David's way of saying, just leave me alone. Let us go in peace. You just go back and take care of the Lord's business in protecting Israel against the Philistines and other enemies, and let us live in peace out here. Verse 15, may he who is therefore be judge and give sentence between me and you. See to it and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand. And as soon as David had finished speaking these words to Saul, Saul said, is that your voice, my son David? And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. He said to David, you are more righteous than I, for you have repaid me good, whereas I have repaid you evil. And you have declared this day how you've dealt with me, in that you didn't kill me when he who has put me into your hands. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safe? So may he who is reward you with good for what you've done to me this day. So Saul is like all teary. He's all crying and sobbing because he knows how close he came to death today. And yet David didn't do it. Saul would have cut his throat, but David wouldn't cut his. And so Saul sees David is such a better man than himself. It's no wonder that he's going to be the next king by God's decision. Verse 20, and now behold, I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Swear to me, therefore, by he who is, that you will not cut off my offspring after me, and that you will not destroy my name out of my father's house. So this is one of those moments of clarity for Saul. He knows that he will soon be dead. I mean, he's an older man by now. I would judge that he's probably somewhere in his early 60s. And he says to David the same thing that David's already made a covenant with Jonathan about. When you do become king, don't wipe my family out. Don't annihilate my family like happens in other kingdoms. And David has no problem making that same oath to the father that he's made to the son, Jonathan. David swore this to Saul. And then Saul went home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. So it seems like Saul, at least for a while, gives up on trying to wipe David out because he understands David really doesn't want to kill him. And David's just going to stay away from him out in the middle of nowhere. And so there's really no reason to chase him down and kill him. At least for a while, that seems to be Saul's practice. Now, there are psalms that David writes right around this same time. And that's where we're going to go next. We're going to go to Psalm 57. Psalm number 57. And we're actually going to launch into quite a few psalms that will take us the next couple of sessions to get through. And I don't want to overanalyze any of these psalms. As I've said to you before, I really think we should feel the emotion of these psalms and just let us hear David's heart in the middle of all of this stuff. Now, some of these psalms have superscriptions, very ancient, maybe not inspired, but certainly historical, that tie the content to events that we're looking at. And that's the case with Psalm 57. The superscription says, to the choir master, according to do not destroy a miktam of David. So that's musical information, apparently about which instrument to use or which tune to use or what style of music to use in presenting this psalm. And then comes the historical tie-in, when he fled from Saul in the cave. So that's the event we just now saw. Let's listen to David's heart. Be merciful to me, O God. Be merciful to me. For in you my shadow takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge till the storms of destruction pass by. Now he's used this phrase before in a psalm that we looked at yesterday, being in the shadow of God's wings. I find it interesting that the terminology used for wings here is also the terminology used for that purple fringe. The position of it on the garment was effectively on the wing of the garment. And so David may have had that kind of as a emotional tie-in, that he kind of clipped Saul's wing, but spared him. And David here is under God's protective wing, waiting for the storm to pass. You know, kind of like mother birds do. You know, they gather their chicks underneath their wings during the height of the storm. Verse number 2, I cry out to God Most High, to God who fulfills His purpose for me. He will send from heaven and save me. He will put to shame him who tramples on me. Selah. And Selah, I think, is a musical term that means put a lot of big music here. God will send out His steadfast love and His faithfulness. So this is a psalm of David's trust in God getting him through these times. Verse 4, my soul is in the midst of lions. I lie down amidst fiery beasts, the children of man whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose teeth or tongues are sharp swords. So this goes to that idea that David is being talked negatively about throughout the kingdom of Saul. David is being lied about to Saul by some of the men he used to work with. And so he pictures them here as lions with nasty teeth that are doing him damage. Verse 5, be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. So David gives praise to God, even in the midst of bad things happening to him. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. They set a net for my steps. My soul was bowed down. They dug a pit in my way, but they've fallen into it themselves. Selah! So bring the music up. So David sees here that the bad guys that he used to work with, that are lying about him, they're trying to get him into trouble. They're trying to hunt him down like an animal. They dig pits. They lay out nets. And yet God keeps bringing him through that and springing that stuff on them instead. Like Saul. Saul's out looking for David, and instead David finds him. My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and make melody. And this is the point at which this psalm shares the first few verses of Psalm 108. So David uses parts of certain psalms in other psalms, and we should be aware of that. My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and make melody. Awake, my glory. And that might be this idea of David trying to rouse himself up. Let's get busy with singing to God. Awake, O harp and lyre. I will awaken the dawn. So he talks about playing his music first thing in the morning as the sun is coming up. I will give thanks to you, O my master, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations. For your steadfast love is great to the heavens, your faithfulness to the clouds. See, David knows God can be trusted. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. When we come back tomorrow, we're going to delve into another psalm from this time period and then introduce a whole bunch of undated psalms of David that have these same emotions inside of them.